Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the NY Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Laufer, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The NY Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrence and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another great episode of NucleCast. You know, as I tell you every episode, we always have great guests, and I'm not failing you again today. I'm going to have a great guest. It's just, it's who we are. It's what we do. Of course, I'm talking about Pranay Vaddi. Now, a lot of you know Pranay. He was at the National Security Council. He was the Senior Director for Arms Control and Special Assistant to the President in the previous administration. He left, that's what happens when administrations turn over. You got to leave, you got to go do something else. And so now he's at the MIT Center for Nuclear Security Policy. You know, he and Vipin Narang are working together, and Austin Long has left the Pentagon and he's now there. So they built a great team to work on nuclear issues and hey, just having a good time and doing a lot of great work. So thanks for joining us on this episode of NucleCast.
Thanks, Adam. It's a pleasure to join you.
So when we were talking before, whenever I asked you to come on the show, one of the things that I thought would be really interesting for our listeners is to get an inside look at what it's like to work on nuclear issues at the National Security Council and in the White House, because we've never really sort of talked from that perspective. And so you've just done that, and you're now in a position where you can talk about what that's like. So I thought that would be a great topic for us. So why don't you kick us off by sort of giving us that insider perspective and, you know, how does it work? What does sort of day-to-day look like? And, you know, what are the things you're considering and who are you working with? Give us all that kind of good detail.
Thanks, Adam. It's a great question. Thanks for having me on. I know you have reach to help educate students, to educate policymakers, to talk to the industry and complex that people sometimes forget about that are so important to maintaining a nuclear deterrent and advancing nuclear policy more generally. So I'm really excited to come on the show. So to your question, in a lot of ways, working at the NSC is like working at any government agency. It can be kind of a boring office job. You have an inbox, you've got employees, you've got management, you've got to write memos, you got to have meetings. And obviously it's distinct because you're getting to work on some of these sensitive national security issues, particularly in the nuclear space where these things have taken on a little bit more prominence in the past few years, despite, you know, my best efforts and the best efforts of some of my colleagues who you mentioned that I get to work with now at MIT. The NSC is a really rewarding place to work for someone who's worked in the national security establishment and other positions. It's a really flat organization, which is unique for working in government. So, you know, we would meet with the National Security Advisor on a very regular, daily, if not more, basis to advise him as to what's going on in our portfolios. We, as a senior director, I had a team of 7 or 8 people who reported to me who were detailees from other agencies, subject matter experts on export controls, multilateral arms control, extended nuclear deterrence, nuclear policy, non-proliferation, the NPT, Iran, you name it. And all of these folks were trying to help coordinate the activities of the agencies around them. So they were running their own meetings. When things required somebody at my level, you know, the assistant secretary level, to chime in and help make a decision, that's when I would have to chair a meeting or run a paper process or what have you. Then, of course, not everything gets decided on nuclear issues at that level of government. That's when you have to take it to deputy cabinet level officials or even the cabinet level and above to the president as necessary. And so you can imagine some of the more White House specific nuclear issues you have to deal with, because all of this, the sort of authority for nuclear weapons management and use, all flows from the president. But when we're trying to write our nuclear strategy, which starts with the presidential nuclear weapons employment guidance, something that we completed in 2024. That's heavily, you know, drafted by, led by, coordinated by the National Security Council staff, and I was really lucky to have knowledgeable folks working for me to help run that process. John Warden was our Strategic Stability and Arms Control Director on my staff, and then work with people like Vipin, who you mentioned, Austin, who you mentioned, Mallory Stewart at the State Department, and their teams to try to get a document like that that is White House-led over the finish line. It's also not maybe surprising to your listeners that a lot of leaders in government aren't looking to have a nuclear-only conversation. We tend to think about a nuclear policy issue coming up in the context of something happening in some part of the world. So if you think about Russia-Ukraine, for example, and the war that began there after Russia's invasion in February of 2022, all of our nuclear risk related discussions and nuclear policy related discussions vis-a-vis Russia had that sort of tinge to it. Everything was sort of stemming from that crisis, that conflict that was ongoing, including our concerns about Russia's interest in using nuclear weapons potentially in the fall of 2022, or the continued attacks against nuclear power plants in Ukraine. So that's when I would work really closely with some of my partners at the NSC who focused on Russia policy or Ukraine policy, NATO policy, etc. And as I mentioned early on, the flat nature of the NSC, everybody's kind of on the same floor at the Eisenhower Executive Office building, let me work with my colleagues very closely, and we would present kind of coordinated policy positions and ideas to our bosses in ways that, as you might know from past stops in your own career, it's really hard to get, you know, a nuclear person and a regional person to agree on something in a standard bureaucracy like at the State Department or DOD. But at the NSC, we did that all the time.
So one of the things that, you know, if, from my experience has been just how hard it is to get the president, for example, to think about nuclear issues, because there's so many domestic policy issues. There's things that will really impact elections that, you know, they're thinking about, whereas nuclear, it tends to be quite hard to get folks to think about them because they don't see that sort of daily regular impact. That's kind of your worst case scenario. And then at that point, you know, potentially, you know, society's ending anyways. So they don't want to think about it. Did you have much luck? And if so, what did you do that sort of made nuclear more prominent? Or was it events, or was it, you know, was there, what was it?
It's a little of both, right? I think you're sort of captive, as you know, as you move up through government, the more senior positions you take, your life is seemingly ruled by your inbox and events happening that are kind of outside of your control, which nobody wants. We want to be in command of our daily lives as much as we can be. The world has not necessarily allowed for that approach to working in the national security bureaucracy over the past few years. I was really lucky to have bosses who, even if they weren't experts in nuclear policy, they had throughout their careers experienced these kind of nuclear events, whether it was negotiations with Iran or you know, things that had happened in the world, such as Russia's nuclear posture changes, post-Crimea, that sort of thing. There are people who had worked in previous administrations that touched on these issues, which was to my benefit. What I try to do is ensure that I was presenting as full a picture as I can to kind of present the benefits and risks profiles on any sort of policy responses I would bring forward. And I also had the benefit of working for a president who had such a long career in public service, who had a lot of overlap with the latter stages of the Cold War as a senator, and had participated in some of the pretty fundamental debates over nuclear posture and arms control that occurred in the 80s. And so you kind of had this these two things working against each other. You had a president who was one of the most familiar with kind of nuclear issues generally and their history, which is rare in your sort of senior leadership, which sort of gave you a good knowledge base for national leadership trying to make decisions on these issues. But it also meant that when you're working on this stuff, you felt it was really important to elevate these issues and get like a gut check. Is this kind of what the National Security Advisor or the president thinks about a given issue? And so part of The skills I had to develop was determining when do we need to go all the way up and when do we need to only go slightly up? When can I make decisions by myself in coordination with my colleagues? Because, you know, as being a national, at the level I was a special assistant to the president and a senior director at the NSC, you don't have a lot of decision space, right? You don't have the legal authority to make decisions unless you're the president at the, you know, in the White House executive office of the president. What I would try to do is convince and cajole my colleagues to make sure that their agencies were in line with a certain course of action so that we as a team could present to our leadership collectively a certain path forward. So I had to develop a sixth sense of when to take things up. One good example for just to use one, you know, when we had to work with the South Koreans on the Washington Declaration, which was essentially this big bilateral recommitment to extended nuclear deterrence, a commitment to enhance extended nuclear deterrence. And that was going to be announced during a presidential level, you know, state visit when President Yoon at the time was visiting Washington. I mean, that's the first time in my memory that two presidents went out there in the Rose Garden and talked about extended nuclear deterrence. And the fact that it happened during Joe Biden's presidency is kind of surprising when you think back on it, given the kind of nuclear politics coming in 2021 and where we ended up in 2023. And so that obviously was an area where we had a ton of up and down coordination, given that the president would be speaking on the issue. We did a ton of work to make sure we tried to appropriately engage the different stakeholders, people who are less in favor of nuclear deterrence, people who are more in favor of nuclear deterrence, and really try to present information to the national leadership that, hey, this is kind of what we think the reactions might be to this statement. This is why we think it's a good idea. And we've tried to cross every T and dot every I we can with the South Koreans because we didn't necessarily feel the same way about every single issue during our time negotiating that text. So that's just one example of where we felt it was really important to have the president's views expressed because it was going to be a presidential level engagement.
Sure. So one of the things that, you know, the National Security Council staff has sort of morphed over the 70 plus years it's existed, and it's gotten big and small. And from your experience, what would you say is kind of that, you know, that three bears, it's just right? You know,
yeah.
What does that look like?
That's a really good question. And I thought a lot about this while I was there. I thought a lot about it afterwards. As we've seen the current administration kind of trim the NSC down a bit. You know, I think the ideal version of the NSC, you kind of think back to the Scowcroft model, right? It's relatively slim. They try to focus on coordinating policy. They try to focus on making sure they're that superhighway kind of up and down the White House to ensure the National Security Advisor and the president are able to be informed about what's happening in the bureaucracy and are also able to direct what's happening in the bureaucracy at the same time. The reality is it's so dependent on whatever times you're in. I think we felt there was so much happening in the world during the last administration. We had on the larger side, you know, of NSCs historically, a lot of directors and senior directors were more involved in direct engagement with counterpart countries. So we'd talk to our allied White House equivalents and National Security Council equivalents, if you will, the Elysee, the Chancellery in Germany, the Cabinet Office in the UK, National Security Staff in Japan or India, the Presidential Office in South Korea, you name it. Because a lot of important national security coordination was actually happening in those elements of our allied countries as opposed to the State Department or DOD, but there were more operational or day-to-day things that were happening at the agency. So we had to try to strike a balance between where the NSC was engaged in some White House diplomacy, and sometimes that was driven by classification, right? Intel that could only be read by certain high-level offices within each government, and sometimes it was for political reasons. And then also what we felt was important to delegate to kind of regular order and regular agencies. And I'm sure many of my colleagues at those agencies both at times were frustrated that the NSC was playing that kind of role, but also at times welcomed that the NSC was going to be there to help try to solve a coordination problem that they were running into and unable to solve on their own. So yes, ideally it would be a smaller, lean, mean fighting machine, and that would work. I think what they discovered early on, and, you know, I got to the NSC in 2022, so I missed the first year. But I think what they discovered is that they needed to kind of beef up expertise and just frankly line officers at the NSC to go and do that work.
This episode of NucleCast is brought to you by the AMLAW Deterrence Center, whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence. So you sort of brought the point up, and that is that relationship that exists between, you know, that permanent bureaucracy, you know, your sort of your senior leaders. You know, for me as an Air Force guy dealing with general officers, you know, over at the Pentagon, you've got SESs that have been there and worked their, you know, way up, general officers, flag officers, and then, you know, take, you know, you or somebody else who comes in and is now sort of operating in a space where you may have folks out in the bureaucracy who are saying, hey, that's mine. And who the hell is this guy or this gal to come in and, you know, meddle with my stuff? How did that, talk to me about that relationship and when you saw it work well, and then when you saw it sort of work terribly, you know, what made the difference in when it worked well versus terribly?
Man, this is a really great question. This kind of goes back to what I said before. I mean, you have to have a sixth sense of when you take things up to your leadership. You also have to have a sixth sense of, like, when are you pushing too hard into someone other's territory. I tried really hard to be respectful of the, not just the, like, portfolios as written down in some sort of internal agency document somewhere, you know, at the State Department, call it the FAM, the Foreign Affairs Manual. So, you know, again, at the NSC, you don't have legal authority. You can't disrupt how an agency wants to run itself. I can't pretend that I'm the guy who gets to, you know, fly the nuclear weapons from point A to point B. It's not my job. So you have to be kind of respectful of what your boundaries are and have a sixth sense as to how far you can push, while also making it clear that the only real power you have at the NSC is your threat to more quickly be able to elevate an issue within your own organization, knowing that, you know, I basically have two stops. I've got a boss and then his boss, and his boss happens to have to run the country. And you have to be cognizant of that being kind of a nuclear card, pun intended, that you could play, but one that you should use sparingly, right?
Yeah.
Speak softly and carry a big stick, as one of my favorite former presidents may have said. So I think you have to just, it's kind of like managing any human relationship, right? Like, know how hard you need to push, how much, because I think one of the things at the NSC that you have to do is, how do you help set another person's agenda, right? Somebody else is a senior level person, maybe even confirmed by the Senate, right? Unlike you, and they have their own priorities. How can you make sure that you slot your priority from the White House from 3-2 or 3-1 in what they're doing that week? I guess the only other thing I'll mention is you also have to try to convene, create an atmosphere. So when you convene a meeting at my level, so we call them IPCs, the current administration probably calls them PCCs, these Policy Coordination Committee meetings. So when I had to have an arms control meeting, and I know particular individuals at DOD are unlikely to be very constructive, but we do have this direction to try to figure out an arms control approach to a certain security problem, and the State Department might be excited about that. How can we ensure that this conversation is going to take place in a way that people who are more worried about the hard security side of the equation feel like their voice is being heard, that their views are going to be expressed as important as well? Because, you know this as well as I do, if you're not going to get the Joint Staff and OSD policy and the services on board with a new arms control proposal, then that thing isn't worth its weight in paper. And so for me, I would have to try to orient the meeting and organize the meeting in a way that everyone felt like they had a fair shot. Because the one thing I wanted to get out of every meeting is I don't want someone to say that they were treated unfairly. I don't want anyone to think that they weren't able to get their viewpoint across. I want them to think that even though we didn't get 100% of what we wanted, we felt like we had fair hearing for our side of issues, and we're going to tell our boss that that was the case. That was easier to talk about now than it was to do in practice, of course. But sure, that was really my goal. There's like a, I don't know, there's like a little bit of a parenting aspect to this, right? Or running a daycare, and not that we wanted to treat the NSC as a parental organization, but it's where a lot of disputes came to be sorted out. And you had to try to do the meeting structure and pre-coordination and back-channel phone calls to make sure everyone would at least be on good behavior, even if they were going to disagree.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've always tried to keep in mind, Reagan once said, you know, he said, an 80% ally is not a 20% enemy. And so if you just keep in mind that there's a lot we agree on, and there's a lot of values and other things we share in common, then we don't have to be enemies because we disagree in certain areas.
Yeah, and we talked about this a little bit before we started recording, but like, particularly in this environment, and I will say I'm biased because when you're at the NSC, you're force-fed all the worst problems in the world, right? I start my very early morning with an Intel brief, and it's how terrible everything is that's going on. That'll be followed by me needing to decide what of the worst problems that I just heard about do I think my superiors need to hear about. When my staff comes in, I check in with them on what they're doing to solve the problem. I mean, you know, it's all problem solving, and it's the worst kinds of problems, all of which we can't even talk about in any detail on podcasts like this. But everyone's there to solve those problems, right? I mean, that's your starting point for every conversation, is we're all here because we're trying to look to improve the country's national security and do our damnedest to protect the average people who don't have to worry about this every single day. They want to go on and live their lives in our country, and we're trying to help them do that. And so you really have to come back to the public service itch or motivation that brought you to the job you're in. And so long as you do that, and it's a kind of an awe-inspiring and humbling thing, I mean, your reason for being there should be able to overcome the little personality differences and things like that that spring up over the course of working in stressful jobs.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I can't agree more. So walk us through, like, what would, for those who may not know, what is a day in the life of an NSC staffer, what does that look like?
So like a lot of jobs, you're trying to fit this bear of a role in the midst of everything else in your life. And so everyone's got kind of different other stuff going on in their life. I've got two small kids. I have a wife. She had a work schedule as well. So I was trying to cram a 14, 15-hour day at the NSC in the midst of all this other stuff going on. So, I mean, part of the big stressor of working in a job like that is, wait, so I'm literally working when I'm not sleeping. And in the NSC like we had, where there's so much happening around the world, there's a fair bit of travel to fit in as well. And so the biggest consideration, I think, for your listeners is you literally only have so many hours in a day. And these portfolios at the NSC are relatively large. So I have arms control, disarmament, and non-proliferation issues. That included export controls. It included working on nuclear policy with my defense directorate colleagues. And we kind of shared the burden there, given our respective expertises and interests in that field. It included extended nuclear deterrence, which is, again, a fair amount of international engagement and engagement with our DoD and state counterparts as well. So it's a big portfolio, and far more than any one person can deal with, which is why you had staff and you have special assistants, and essentially, like, it's too much for one brain to deal with, so you spread it across a few different brains at the same time. But my approach, I live outside the city, so I had to deal with traffic. I would try to miss rush hour by coming in early, leaving my house by 5 a.m. at the latest, getting in at 6 if I could, maybe sneak a workout in if I can. Digging out of whatever I needed to from overnight, you know, emails from my boss from the night before, because I don't have a skiff at my house. So, you know, that's part of why you need to stay in your office for so damn long. Catching up on editing any documents that my staff were proposing, because directors at the NSC, as you mentioned, they're the kind of links to the agencies. They come from these agencies. They run the meetings at the first level, you know, sub IPCs or sub PCCs to deal with a particular issue that's come up. So they're writing a lot of the summaries of those meetings. They're writing discussion papers for those meetings to summarize sort of what are we here to meet about? What do we hope to get out of this? What do we hope our policy recommendations are for the next level meeting that'll make final decisions? I would always try to review those before they were sent out for coordination. So I would have essentially an hour to 2 hours of read time in the morning before my Intel briefer showed up. And that's how I would spend another 30 minutes to an hour, is just catching up on what's happened. And I did that every day, what happened in the last day, basically. Generally after 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, that's when some of the internal meetings may start. So that's when maybe the national security advisor, the deputy national security advisor, that level of person may convene internal meetings on Russia, China, you know, what's happening around the world. Obviously, the Russia-Ukraine conflict ongoing led to sort of daily coordination. So we met every day on that topic. Obviously, I would also try to schedule the meetings that I had to run. So if I had to run an IPC meeting starting at 10 or 11 o'clock, some days I could have like 3 IPC meetings in a day, and that would eat the bulk of my normal core work hours till 4 or 5 o'clock. Other days, maybe I wouldn't have one at all, and I would have external meetings. I'd have to go give a talk at an agency or meet at a different agency. Maybe I would have a call with foreign counterparts or host visiting foreign counterparts who are making the rounds in D.C. to talk about an issue. But essentially, that time period between 9 and 5 or 6 was all meetings for somebody who's a senior director. On the rare occasion it wasn't, maybe I'd get to write, maybe I'd get to review or edit something. Maybe I'd get to meet with my staff who've been probably waiting for hours for a breather for me so they could like come talk to me about a problem they're having or ask for advice. Then usually the end of the day, kind of after 6 or 6:30, when I think the meeting schedule has really died down, sometimes there might be a kind of a last meeting with the leadership on any other issue that is of some urgency, but usually that's when I'm trying to think about when can I leave today. So 6:30 to 7:30 or 8 is maybe when I'm trying to wrap up everything I can. Usually that's when my staff could finally get a hold of me and meet with me and sit down and ask for advice on, a meeting they're preparing for me for tomorrow, for example, the next day. And so that was kind of the average day. And then you kind of do that rinse and repeat. Obviously, some weeks it was a little bit less than that. Maybe I was traveling, and so I got to leave the office at 2 to go to Dulles instead of sit there until 8 o'clock. Other days, the meeting schedule might just be a little bit lighter, and I have a little bit more office time. But I think one thing to keep in mind is if that's the average day, imagine the day when something new happened in the world. Some new critical problem came up. And as I mentioned, the NSC is a flat organization. You don't always get to determine your own schedule. There's a certain amount of this work as a senior official at the White House you get to cover. But as you know, you always have a boss. And in many cases, you have multiple bosses. And sometimes they get to decide your schedule, too. So if there's a deputies committee meeting, for example, on a topic that I am interested in or need to be interested in, maybe it's on Russia, for example, and there's always kind of a nuclear element to every discussion about Russia, you need to attend those as well. And maybe there's a principals committee meeting or a NSC meeting as well on topics that touch on your issues. And so you need to find out how to wiggle your way into those meetings and attend them too, because they're often only open to people who are senior directors and above. So you can't have staff cover note-taking for those meetings, for example, all the time. So the White House is a very meeting-heavy organization, as you can probably gather from my description of the average day.
And so how long would you, for the folks out there who say, that sounds great, I would love to do that, how long would you tell them you can handle it for this long?
So look, there are people who did it all 4 years, and I don't know how they did it. I ended up, so I worked basically May of 2022 through January of this year, so a little more than 2.5 years, 2 years, 9 months, something like that. I felt tired when I left. I was running on fumes. You don't see your family a lot. Obviously, if you have small kids, I was hopefully getting home to put them to bed. But like literally as they're like getting into bed. And I really tried to save my weekends as much as possible and not go into work on Saturdays if I could avoid it. Sometimes I was successful in doing that. Other times I was not. I really do think it's up to the individual. If you have a family, if you have younger kids, if you have a spouse who works and is busy too, that all adds to the amount of the number of balls you're trying to juggle at once as a human being. Mm-hmm. I have a really understanding spouse. I have really resilient kids. I was able to do this for almost 3 years. Could I have done it for 4 years? Maybe. But I'm not sure. I was pretty much getting to the end of my endurance. And also, I think it's one of those jobs where it's you know, usually most people after, I think generationally, you know, you and I maybe have similar generations and people maybe younger than us, probably every 2 or 3 years, they're thinking about like, you know, should I go do something else? Should I stretch into a different field? Because, you know, and you're lucky if you can do that. If you can kind of have a skill set that's translatable into many different sectors, that's a great thing to have. And having that career flexibility makes you more well-rounded. So I'm not knocking it. The NSC is a type of place, like it's kind of hard to think about what you're doing next. Like it's so all consuming. And for listeners who do want to work there, you should. It has been and will always be the most rewarding experience I've ever had. I got to work there at what I think is a relatively pivotal moment for working on these types of issues. It's hard to think of working anywhere else in government after it. In part because you probably, by the end of your tenure, are one of the least popular people, having beaten up on all of your friends and colleagues in the interagency for years. But there's something to be said for working on nuclear issues at the center of it all. You don't get to do that much. And that I'm sure people say the same thing about getting to work at Stratcom or places sure. like that in the enterprise. So, yeah, I think there is certainly a time limit, but you kind of have to see what it's like for yourself. And it's again, determined by all these other factors that are not necessarily in your control, but certainly affect your longevity on any job.
Now, before we end the show, I want to make sure I bring out Bob the Genie. And so as I rub my magic lamp, of course, Bob grants all guests 3 wishes. Now, he only stipulates that you got to sort of stick to the boundaries of the topics we've discussed. So with that in mind, Pranay, what is your first wish?
Okay. I think my first wish is, maybe it's a dorky one, but continuity in how the United States approaches fundamental nuclear strategy, particularly extended nuclear deterrence. I think that this is we've entered an era in which this is actually much more important to talk about, but also in talking about it, we shouldn't look to undo what has worked. We should look to improve what has worked. And so that'd be the wish number one for me, because I think that's so crucial to our non-proliferation policy, our relationship with friendly countries like our close allies, and everything else that makes this country so great and influential in the world right now.
Yeah, that's a good first wish. How about wish number two?
Man, wish number two. I really, really, really hope that no country tries to use a nuclear weapon, period, and that the norm against the use of nuclear weapons continues, not just for the 80 years it has, but for another 80 years on top of that. And obviously that requires us to both focus on whatever we can to reduce nuclear risk, including enhancing nuclear deterrence. And these things all work together. I think we talked a little bit about the show before the show started. We tend to try to bring team tribal politics and partisan politics into these discussions. It's really important we don't do that. Maybe I'm getting 2 wishes out of 1 there. No nuclear use. Let's go with that.
Was there ever a day in which you thought, son of a gun, today's the day that a nuclear weapon is employed? Did you ever have that feeling? Was there ever that day?
Not like today's the day. I try to be as even-keeled as possible in general in life.
Yeah.
But, you know, fall of 2022, this is something that has been talked about in Bob Woodward's book, and David Sanger's written about it in the New York Times. There's a reason why, like, people were looking so closely at this. And I hope in hindsight, 10 years down the road, maybe we got it all wrong, and maybe the risk wasn't really there, and we were over-indexing. I feel pretty confident in saying today that I don't think that we were overly worried about it. I think we were appropriately worried about it. And so I had that feeling that, Jesus Christ, I come into this job, I'm only here for a few months, and already we're like looking at the norm, the sort of non-use norm ending. Like, what did I screw up? I'm like the one nuclear person here at the NSC. and of course, these things are bigger than any one person. But yeah, I mean, that's sort of where that went through my head. And I'm very happy to be on the other side of it. But again, I think it's a sign of the times. There's probably people in the Trump administration right now who are wondering, you know, how unstable are our nuclear politics in the world right now? Do we have to worry about this type of thing happening on our watch? No one wants it to happen on anyone's watch.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so you're down to your last wish. What is that final wish?
In my final wish, I guess, I really do hope, I think the president referenced in January wanting to have these kinds of arms control discussions with Russia and China. And this isn't partisan, but, you know, every president has wanted to do this. And I think it's appropriate for every president to want to do this. Every president has a healthy fear of nuclear use and wants to find ways to reduce that risk. I sincerely hope that the president is able to have one conversation with Russia as New START expires. I personally think that whatever a new negotiation or agreement should look like has to take into account however the United States needs to change its arsenal to deal with the emergence of China as a large nuclear armed adversary, maybe not a peer, but it's certainly not a lesser included case anymore. But I want the president to be successful in his diplomatic efforts. I think it's the odds are against any U.S. president right now at trying to get these two adversaries to have a constructive conversation. But as we look to our own modernization needs and what more needs to be done to the U.S. nuclear posture, I don't think anyone wants to spend more money or do more things in this particular niche area of our national defense than is necessary. The problem has been we haven't been able to get these strategic arms control conversations going again. So I think President Trump has this unique opportunity to sort of throw caution to the wind and engage in personal diplomacy. I wish him luck. I hope it does work out. Otherwise, you know, maybe there'll be a podcast 9 months from now where we're talking about what's the force posture got to look like when we don't have arms control. And obviously some of that analysis is happening now, and Vipin and Austin and I have been talking about that too. But wouldn't it be great to have one last little problem to solve? Because then we could really focus on China a little bit more.
Yeah, for sure. All right. Well, now as we end the podcast, is there any sort of like a final thought that you would like to leave with the NucleCast audience?
Yeah, I think I guess my final thought is this, and I try to do a lot of as much mentorship and conversations. Anytime someone reaches out to me who's earlier mid-career, or maybe they just got kicked out of government, who wants to grab coffee, I try to encourage folks to engage in the discussion. Don't be afraid of having ideas. Don't be afraid of debating. There are always going to be gatekeepers on these issues, whether you work on nuclear deterrence or disarmament or non-proliferation or arms control. The whole, you know, don't be a jerk thing should apply to everybody. But you should also not be afraid to engage in the discussion. You know, I have my thoughts on the basis of the, you know, 10, 15 years I've spent working on these issues. You have yours based on your expertise and career as well. Obviously, given the way that the world is shaken out on these issues, none of us have had all the right answers to dealing with these problems. And so we don't need to self-edit. We need to actually try to solve some real problems here. I think it's all for the public good, whether you work in the academic space or in the government space. So I encourage folks to try to take their shots when they can. Talk to people like us. Talk to people older than you, younger than you, you name it. And try to publish and try to engage in ideas. The one thing that irritated me the most working at the NSC was observing there's sort of a community of people who kind of don't publish and don't say things and don't write. They kind of wait for someone else to do it, and then they just kind of explain why that's wrong. That's all well and good, but you got to put ideas out there too. There are too many problems to solve to just wait for, you know, Adam to publish something about how he thinks we need to solve a problem, then everyone to come in and say, well, actually, that doesn't work for the following reasons. It's like, okay, go write your own thing. You know, let's have absolutely. A debate. Let's have a discussion.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with that. That's something that I've long thought, so I'm glad you said it. All right. Well, thanks for joining us, Pranay. It's been a great discussion. Glad to have you. This was really good. I think the audience is going to really enjoy this episode.
Good, Adam. I was happy to do it. Thanks for all your questions and having me on. I hope it'll help your audience get a little glimpse into what life is like at the NSC, because hopefully some of your listeners are people who want to work in government one day on these issues, which unfortunately are back and right at the center of how we manage our national security affairs today.
Absolutely. So thanks to Pranay Vaddi, and thanks to you, the listeners, for joining us on this episode, and we'll see you next time. What a great discussion. You know, that was, just two dudes having a discussion about, kind of a work, you know, what's your work like? This is what it's like. So it was a great discussion. You know, Pranay, gave a really good sort of inside look at, you know, the National Security Council and what it's like to work there and sort of what you think about, what are your concerns. And so really glad he was able to come on NucleCast. Hopefully you enjoyed it as well.
This has been a production of the Anwar Deterrence Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Krunkel. Help us grow our followers by sharing it and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NuclearCast.